You're listening to the Overeaters Anonymous Mid-Peninsula podcast. Overeaters Anonymous is a fellowship of individuals who, through shared experience, strength, and hope, are recovering from compulsive overeating. Our primary purpose is to abstain from compulsive eating and compulsive food behaviors and to carry the message of recovery through the 12 steps of OA to those who still suffer. For more information, please visit oamidpeninsula.org.
Hi, kids. I'm a recovered compulsive eater and a member of the Pass It On group. My name is Gary. Howdy. So nice to hear so much abstinence. It's really wonderful. I'm not in How. I was about maybe 20 years ago. I went to How for a while just to kind of check it out. I believe my food plan now is pretty close to the, I don't remember. I barely remember breakfast. But I believe my food plan is pretty close to the How food plan. But at any rate, I'm not in How, and there are reasons for that. So let's talk about recovery. Thank you for inviting me to what apparently has turned out to be a women's meeting. I hope I'm still welcome here. Let's see what I have to say. I've been an active member of Overeaters Anonymous for 32 years, and I mean almost 33, and active. I've been active in region and in world service, intergroup, in terms of service, but also just really like in the center of the room since I got here, and threw myself into OA to begin with, and thrilled that I did so. I have to say, the How meetings probably isn't as necessary, because I know you guys have very definite abstinence, but I've been active in OA for 32 years, but I haven't been abstinent for 32 years. As far as I know, I haven't eaten sugar in 32 years. I mean, I would imagine somewhere in 32 years, somebody, you know, I ordered a Diet Coke and somebody brought me a Coke, or I had something that had a sauce in it that had sugar that I didn't know about. But I haven't knowingly had sugar in 32 years. And people talk about that a lot, like it's a big deal. But the thing is, I didn't join Sugars Anonymous. I joined Overeaters Anonymous. So I haven't been abstinent for 32 years, not because I've eaten sugar or what are now called alcoholic foods. I love that phrase, alcoholic foods, because this is just my experience. My alcoholic food is called food. So it's not like I have certainly overeaten over the last 32 years. In fact, there was one point where I was convinced I was abstinent because I wasn't eating any of, you know, what they now call alcoholic foods. I wasn't eating any crap. I was gaining weight, and I was still pretty sure I was abstinent. I was saying to my friend Teresita, I said, I understand what's going on. I'm abstinent, but I'm gaining weight. And she said, well, if you're gaining weight, what are you abstaining from? Clearly it's not overeating, because as it turns out, if you're gaining weight, it's because you're eating more than your body needs. That was news to me, but it turns out that's just the way it works. So, my first response, of course, is wanting to slap her, but she was right on the money, man. She was right on the money. I had to learn, the point. Like, for me, volume matters. For me, I've never really wanted to binge on broccoli or anything like that, but broccoli is a gateway drug. It really, at least for me, if I stuff myself on broccoli today and tomorrow, the next day it's going to be sweet potatoes, and a couple of days after that, and sooner or later, who knows? There's no way of knowing where that ends. I was going to say, for me, overeating is the thing. It's not just what I eat. And my food plan, like yours, tells me what to eat and when to eat. And thank God, because if I had to make that decision on my own, I'd be dead now. Anyhow, I'm just so grateful for this way of life. Those of you who are new to OA, welcome. It is just a great way of life. I'm going to talk about the gift of the steps rather than go too much about my history. So it's just when I got here and they talked about the first step, when I heard I am powerless over food, my life is unmanageable by me. First of all, I found that kind of painful. I still find it painful to be powerless. It hurts. But the only thing that hurts more is not admitting it. I don't like admitting that I'm bald. I'd rather not be bald. But you can live in delusion. The truth is I'm bald, and the truth is I'm a Paul Sweeter, I can't manage my food. There was some relief in that. And there was some, when I was a kid, a teenager, I was living in the Caribbean. My dad was a career criminal, and I was a criminal too. And he had to leave the country to avoid going to jail, and I had to leave the country to avoid going to reform school. So we were living in the Caribbean, and he was a compulsive eater, and he was going through one of those phases where he was dealing with his compulsive eating by having no food at all in the house, just none. And I was in the house, and I was having a carb craving. Just had to have carbs, and it wasn't a matter of choice. I had to. And I had this thought, we didn't have any food in the house, but we did have a German Shepherd. And the German Shepherd had milk bones, which are like a dog treat. And I had the thought, oh man, there are milk bones. And that's the thing about food addiction. It starts with, like to read the story of the guy with the milk, is that suddenly I had a thought, you know, like it always starts with a thought. And that's why I'm very careful. I don't romance my thoughts around food at all. Like, you know, if something comes in, I deal with it right away. Because if I let it dwell in my head long enough, I'm going to lose, you know, I mean, it's just the way it is. So eventually I had the thought, and the thought won, the insane idea won out. And I had a dog biscuit, and it was disgusting. It was terrible. And the second one wasn't any better. And the third one wasn't any better. The more I ate, they didn't get any better, but I ate them. And the point there is, especially if you're a newcomer, nobody does that by choice. You know, if I had some power over food, nobody gets up in the morning and says, gee, I feel like having dog biscuits. You know, like if I had a choice in the face of that craving, I wouldn't have done it. In fact, the first time I told that story was at a beginner's meeting with a format similar to this. And there were a bunch of women in there who were mostly what I thought of as older. They were probably younger than I am now. And I told that thing about dog biscuits, and some women in the front row went like that. Like I shocked them. I was like, man, if you can shock people in OA, that's like, you know, you people have all eaten out of garbage cans and crap, and I'm shocking you about what I ate. So, after the meeting, I'm walking out with my friend Maxine, and I said to her, was that really disgusting? Because to tell you the truth, it's not in the top 10. Like in terms of disgusting crap I did for food, it's not in the top 10. And she goes, well, it's only really disgusting if you had to wrestle them away from the dog. You know, like she knew, like there's no choice around this stuff. I sponsored a guy who weighed 700 pounds. He didn't wake up one day and say, I want to weigh out. Oh, I should have mentioned this before. I'm about 130 pounds lighter than I was when I came in. And that matters, just so you know. Weight, like people say, weight doesn't matter. It doesn't matter once you've lost the weight, but when you're 130 pounds overweight, sure as crap it matters. Like, damn straight. I'd be dead. That's the thing. I've already had some heart attack. I'd be dead if I hadn't lost the weight. Anyhow, so I took the first step, and I'm a fairly bright fellow, and I was listening to people. And I got right away that this was a God-based thing, that God was in this thing. It says it in all the steps. I was in a club room, but the writing was on the wall. People were talking about God. And more importantly, everybody I knew who had any kind of recovery that I wanted talked about God. That was in fact, they talked about that more than anything else, certainly more than food. But here's the thing. I wasn't really an atheist. What I was, I was extremely obnoxious. So like whatever side you were on, I was gonna argue with it. Like if you believed in God, I was gonna tell you why there's no God. If you didn't believe in God, I was gonna tell you why there's. And my sponsor, of course, believed in God. So I'm arguing with my sponsor, I'm telling him why there can't be no God, there's no such thing as God. And he did the smartest thing he could do. He didn't argue with me. Somebody's unmuted. He didn't argue with me. What he did was he said, I don't give a hoot what you believe. He didn't say hoot, but you can get the gist. He said, I don't give a hoot what you believe. He said, you can't manage your relationship with a fork. So God hasn't chosen to reveal the nature of the cosmos to you, Moses. He said it just like that. And I was like, really taken aback. He goes, if you want to get well, and if you're a newcomer, here's the deal. If you want to get well more than you want to eat, it is your job to find a way to believe in God with some higher power. The book says God, and I believe the book. So the book says God. Find some way, and that's what I did. I found some way to believe in God. I have believed much more ridiculous things than that. I maybe shouldn't mention this at a women's meeting, but I can't tell you how many times I convinced myself, you know, that stripper really likes me. She's into me. If I can convince myself of that, the stuff about the God thing wasn't a big deal. So I got on my knees, because that's what I asked somebody, how do you get this God stuff? And they said, get on your knees and ask for faith. So I got on my knees, and when I was in treatment, there was this woman named Mallory, and she had just come back from India, which meant she was very spiritual because that's where God lives, apparently. I didn't know this then, but apparently God lives in India, not Brooklyn or not Miami, but you know, like, I guess he's here, but India is like the real God place, apparently. And she was wearing a lot of linen and Birkenstocks and stuff like that and kind of floating around the treatment center. So I got on my knees, and the first thing I said was, God, I'm a friend of Mallory's. Because that was her name, and I wanted him to know that I wasn't just some schnook. I was like a friend of Mella. I was connected. But I was on my knees, and I get choked up whenever I say this, but I don't even know where the words came from. But I got on my knees, and I said, God, please redeem me. Please make me new. And redemption wasn't a word. It wasn't like part of my lexicon. It wasn't something I would normally say or think. It was just, please redeem me and make me new. And I have to say, he did. You know, from that moment on, the decision to live by spiritual principles changed my life. It absolutely altered me. And it's not just that the sky was bluer and the grass was greener. It was more like, I decided to take the spiritual life for real. You know, I decided that I was going to live, you know, not to get, but to give. And it changed literally everything in my life. And if you are new, one of the great advantages of doing a third step is you get to take a third step with other people when you sponsor them. And I can't tell you how many times I've been on my knees with another guy holding hands and praying the third step prayer for the first time. And, excuse me, I don't know, allergies. I think. How many times we cried together? God must want me to shut up. I'll tell you something. When my mother was dying, she was always kind of jealous about this spiritual thing I had going on. And she was in the hospital, and she said to me, I'd like to do that spiritual stuff you do and get close to God the way you do. But she said like this, she goes, but it has to be Jewish. None of that crazy Christian stuff you do, because I do all kinds of stuff. And she said, it has to be Jewish. And I held her hand. She was in her wheelchair. And I got on my knees, and we talked a little bit. And then we did third step prayer together. And she cried just the way like sponsees cry when they first see God for the first time. I come from a really abusive background, sexually abusive, physically abusive. I could have died at the hands of either my parents very easily. It's just such a rare gift. Very few men get to do that with their mothers. Very few people get to, but especially men. I mean, the vast majority of men who survived what I've survived die in jail. I'm a statistical anomaly because of this program. I had just that rare opportunity to do that with my mother. What a gift. You know, people talk about these working the steps, they make it sound so, I don't know, like drudgery, man. These gifts are such a gift. It's such a, like, such a blessing, man. My mother's passed now, and I'm so glad I had that experience with her. You know, the fourth step, man, I got, the vast majority of people in the last 30 seconds of life go, wait, man, I never got to know who I am. I never got to be, wait, I didn't know. Because we are forced into this. Bill Wilson says it is not virtue that leads us to this, but necessity. Our lives depend upon it. But because of the first step, I got an opportunity to learn who I was before I die, to spend my life with an awareness of who Gary Davis is and what I'm about, but you know, like, and the truth of what I am. And what a remarkable, at the end of Death of a Salesman, I know this is kind of outside literature, but then the Death of a Salesman, I hope this doesn't, ruin this for anything. By the end of Death of a Salesman, the salesman dies, you know, hence the title. So they're at the funeral, and Biff looks down at the grave and says, here's the real tragedy of Willie Loman. Here's the real tragedy. He never got to know who he is. You know, we do. And again, not because we earned it, not because of some virtue, but because God loves us enough to give us this program. And the fifth step, I've discovered intimacy with another man. I mean, I shared myself with somebody. I really let somebody know me. And the fifth step, my first one, I've done several, but my first one, I really felt like I joined this fellowship. I really did. Like I was doing stuff. You know, it wasn't just lip service. And the sixth and seventh step, I come from a long line of criminals, like I said earlier, con men and con artists. And what a change it is to try and develop character for its own sake. You know, not for what I can get for it, not being a nice guy. I was a nice guy because if I was nice, you would give me crap. But to really try and alter my character to be a better human being, to be closer to God, to be more of what God would have me be. What a dedication, what a change in me. And it makes my life so much happier. I always thought I had a getting problem. Like if I just had enough, if I got this, if I got that, I'd be happy. And it never worked. It turned out I didn't have a getting problem. I had a giving problem. You know, I had a problem with initially I had nothing to give. And I had to be in recovery long enough to have something to give, to be able to share with people. This is what it's like to be recovered. This is what it's like to have this kind of life. And so six and seven, man, you know, six is about the willingness to change, and seven is about the humility to seek that change. And for me as an egomaniac, humility is what a blessing, man. Anything I really say about humility is kind of theoretical. So bear with me when I talk about it, but just to have the minute amount of humility that I've been blessed with is just such freedom in that, just freedom in it. What happens to me isn't all that important. And when I did the eighth step by itself, not even talking about making the amends, just the willingness to make amends, to clear up my past. I told you I come from this really abusive background. Right? Both my parents were remarkably violent, and there was sexual abuse as well. And I could have died at the hands of either of my parents. And I was doing the eighth step. I was getting to my father about being willing to make amends to him for stealing $5 here and there and doing this stuff. And I went to my sponsor and I said, I did this stuff to my father. And I went, but he did this, what he did was so, so out of the picture compared to what I was making amends for. And my sponsor said, he said this so simply and directly. He said, why don't you just forgive him like that? Why don't you just forgive him? And I heard that as if he said, why don't you just levitate? Why don't you just float around the room for an hour? Forgive him. It was and here's the thing. I forgave him. I forgave my parents. And I was taught that forgiveness doesn't mean forgetting. I was talking to a friend of mine this morning and saying, forgiveness doesn't take away the pain. Just because, if a blind man steps on my toe, I forgive him, but it still hurts. It doesn't take the pain away. I forgave him. I was taught that forgiveness simply means surrendering my right to revenge. Surrendering my right to get even with him and letting that go. And that's the idea. I let go of my right to revenge, and it changed. A friend of mine says that the 12 steps don't just change your present and your future, they also change your past. And they did. All of a sudden, I started remembering pleasant things from childhood. All of a sudden, I started loving my parents, which was not an easy thing to do. Loving some people requires more effort than loving others. And my parents were people who loving was a real challenge. But again, what a gift. What a gift to learn how to love even people who are kind of unlovable. In a million years, I never would have come to that on my own. In a million years. I know I'm near the end here. So it's not 10, 11, and 12. Living in 10, 11, and 12 means you're just living a great life. The 10th step promises, I identify as a recovered compulsive eater because I treated those 10th step promises as an inventory. I have stopped fighting everything and anyone. I have, I am in a position of neutrality. All those things were true for me. I said, wow, man, sounds recovered. Being close to God, my God time now is, I know it's a little ridiculous, but it's like an hour in the morning and an hour and a half sometimes between my reading and my meditating. But it's a great time. I've done and do a lot of service, and taking people through the steps is like the greatest pleasure I know. If you're a newcomer, and it didn't sound like many of you are in the opening of this meeting, but if you're a newcomer, I just want to echo what it says in the big book. It says, we beg of you to be fearless and thorough from the very start. I echo that. I beg you, be fearless and thorough from the very start. This is just a fantastically joyous way of life. I don't know anybody who's ever asked for their money back. God, this program and you people have saved, not only saved my life, but given me a life worth living. If there's ever anything I can do to return the favor, please let me know. And thank you so much for letting me ramble on.